Hey, welcome everybody. This is the eighth and final lecture for our middling class on Rothbard, Production and the Market Process. And we're just wrapping up. We're going through a bunch of stuff from Chapter 9 that we didn't cover last week. Let me just adjust the camera there. So the first topic I want to touch on is this issue of backward bending supply curves. So here we have the standard, and this is typically couched in the context of the labor market. So this is the standard way you would see it presented. This isn't from Rothbard. I just got this off the internet. So here's the price axis. You got the wage rate. And then here's the quantity axis. And this is the supply curve. So the idea is so that you can see why it's called backward sloping. So the idea is instead of it being a regular upward sloping one, it is for a certain range, but then eventually it bends back on itself. All right, so what is it saying? That at a certain wage rate, W1 here, the quantity supplied is L1, you increase the wage rate up to W2, and like a well-behaved supply curve, the quantity increases out to L2, but then strangely, if you increase the wage rate even more, the quantity falls to L3, so L3 is less than L2. Okay, so that seems to be a violation of the law of supply, that it's showing the, even holding other things equal, as the price of labor goes up, at least in some regions of the price, the quantity of labor supplied goes down. So that's sort of odd. So the way Austrians typically handle this is they say it's actually not a violation of the law of supply because the law of supply says other things equal. And here, other things aren't equal. In particular, what's going on is the, first of all, before I get into this, let's just make sure that you understand this is not merely a theoretical curiosity. I mean, this is probably true of all of us, even in our own individual lives in terms of just current society and also the human race, if you will, over the centuries. So right now, human beings, especially in industrialized countries, tend to work shorter work weeks than they did 300 years ago. And the hourly real wage rate now is far higher on average than it was for the typical human being 300 years ago. So that is one way of looking at it in terms of if you're looking at the market as a whole. But even if you want to just look at a specific individual, the specific individual's preferences, just boom, taking a snapshot in time, it also is true that, you know, you might say, okay, if I make, you're working in a factory and they offer bonus pay on holidays or something, and, you know, maybe you want to get those shifts. Like I remember when I was younger, I actually liked working holidays. Because for one thing, I wouldn't have to like hang out with my relatives. It was awkward. You know, I could just come in, you know, work a lot, and then just come in right before the meal happened or something. And say, yeah, well, I was at work all day. But then also, they paid more. And so, you know, if you're going to work, you might as well get to log in your hours on a holiday when you're getting holiday pay. So that would be true there. But then after, so there, that would be the normal upward sloping portion, showing as the wage rate goes up, the quantity of hours you want to supply goes up. But, and you would also expect, too, that for a particular market, you know, not just looking at the individual, but a particular market, you would think that would make sense, that as the wage rate went up, more people would be attracted to that sector, and so the quantity of hours supplied would go up. But even back to the individual, so sure, going from the normal pay to holiday pay, that's like whatever, 50 cents an hour higher. When I was working at the grocery store, I don't remember what it was, but it was, you know, some nominal amount. That elicits more hours. But if you start getting up even more and more, then it would go down. So right now, for example, I give talks, after dinner talks, places, and I charge a decent amount. And if people were, you know, willing to pay more, and so that the price went up, I would do more of those. So right now, I typically go somewhere maybe once or twice a month. You know, that I'll get on a plane, fly out somewhere, stay in a hotel, go to some dinner, and then give a talk after dinner, or I'll be one of the participants in that conference. Okay, and so I do that once or twice a month right now. And I have a certain price in mind, and if people are willing to offer me that price, I do it, and if not, I won't. And so in that sense, if you looked at my behavior, it would show that, you know, if the equilibrium price were in a certain range, I'd be going twice a month. If it were lower than that, I'd go zero. And if it were higher, I'd be willing to go, you know, I'd go 10 times a month if they paid me triple what they pay me right now. They'd love to do that. But let's say I get to be as popular as, Paul Krugman or something, or Bill Clinton, let's say, who I think, you know, can get, depending on the venue, I mean, he can get anywhere $25,000 or more to just show up and give a talk. I wouldn't be doing that probably 8 times a month for very long if I was getting $25,000 a pop. Because after a while, you would be so wealthy that just, you know, on the margin, that wouldn't be worth it to you. You'd want to relax. So what's going on there? There's two things. There's the substitution effect and there's the income effect. So normally, I see in the comments here, Matt says that Clinton has gotten between $250,000 and $1.5 million for talks. Right? I mean, I knew that they were astounding numbers. I just didn't want to say something off the top of my head that was totally wrong. But yeah, I've seen the figures he gets. I mean, Judge Napolitano probably gets in the range that I said. Okay, based, you know, for certain venues at least. So, incidentally, guys, just you would be astounded if you saw how much people can get just for showing up and giving talks. If, you know, especially if it's like for a corporate event. Doug French had a good article the other day about the bankers who got bailed out and the parties they were throwing, and like Elton John, if he goes to a private event in Vegas, like at somebody's, you know, like some rich guy's 65th birthday party or 40th wedding anniversary, that kind of thing, and they want to, you know, they'll get groups like Huey Lewis in the News or Elton John or somebody to come in, and it's a very intimate thing, and they'll, you know, they'll sing a bunch of their hits for whatever, 500 people that are in the room. And so these guys are loaded, and it's like they're trying to impress their guests and just show, you know, how rich they are. And so, like, Elton John will get $1 million just for showing up somewhere and playing, you know, his songs for an hour. Right. So anyway, I think you guys would be surprised if you saw the speaking fee that various people get. So anyway, back to the point. Economically, the way you explain that, and this isn't a uniquely Austrian point, this is like general mainstream economics, is they'll say, well, there's two different things going on there. On the one hand, there's what's called the substitution effect, where is the relative prices change. If you're the seller, that makes you more likely to engage in the thing that's not more lucrative. But then there's also the income effect. And so when it comes to labor, the reason you're seeing this backward bending supply curve, the people tend to associate that with labor in particular, is that the good, in order for you to sell labor, you have to consume less leisure. Whereas if you're the owner of a factory that's cranking out widgets, as the market price of widgets goes up, it's not, you know, you can still, the richer you get, you're not all of a sudden going to retire. Right, because you can probably delegate a lot of the responsibility to other people. Maybe not if it's a kind of business where you have to be there 80 hours a week, or else it doesn't work. That maybe, you know, even if the price goes up, you will eventually retire, and the quantity produced will go down. But in general, I'm trying to explain why people associate this with labor is because that's the one area where, as your wage rate goes up, eventually, you know, your income per time period is so high that you want to start spending a lot of it consuming leisure, and so that's why your output goes down. So anyways, that's what the backward bending labor supply curve is. Now Rothbard makes a good point, and this shows why Rothbard's such an interesting writer, is that he knows the standard stuff and he'll cover the same material that other textbooks would, but then he thinks outside the box. You know, he's a very clever guy and imaginative, and he's not afraid to just go out on a limb and start talking about things that aren't typically covered. So here, I used to think this myself with this point I'm about to go over, but I never saw I never learned this in a standard economics textbook. They always make the case. They always do backward bending supply curves about labor, and then they move on. So anyway, Rothbard makes the point that it's not really that there's something unique about labor per se. Really what's going on with the backward bending supply curve is that there's a non-catalactic use for the resource, which in this case is, you know, the use of your body, or the direction of services flowing from your body, or if you want to describe it. The point is you can sell that for money, which is what we classify as selling labor and getting wages, or you can consume leisure. Whereas, like I say, for lots of other potential things you could be selling, that isn't really the case. But Rothbard points out, if you own land that to you has a lot of aesthetic value, like just the intrinsic beauty of it, or if you have strong emotional connections to it and would prefer that the land not be developed commercially, well, then you might get something like a backward bending supply curve for that resource also. So, for example, if you, I'm trying to think of a good example. Let's say somehow the government, because of the budget crisis or whatever, the government reads some of my old articles and privatizes all its assets, the U.S. government, federal government. And so all of the, Yellowstone National Park and all of the parks and wilderness areas that the federal government owns right now, they just sell off to people in the private sector. And so you come into possession because your grandfather got it and gives it to you or whatever, but you own just a bunch of forest that has never been developed. Like it's old world redwoods, right? So these giant trees that are 1,000 years old and they're so wide that cars can drive through them, and you own it now. And the federal, you know, you are the owner, you can do whatever you want with it. So if you want to, you can have loggers come in and chop all the trees down and put up shopping malls. So Rothbard's point is, depending on the specifics, you can imagine that the owner of that sort of resource might have a strong desire that, you know, if he were wealthy enough, part of what he would spend his wealth on, or his income, would be the preservation of this thing. Just like if you're wealthy enough and if you have a high enough income, one of the things you would want to do is consume a lot of leisure every time period. So it's the same, it's an analogous thing here. And so if you're the owner of that, you know, the way that would manifest itself is that you're the owner of that resource, and for low unit prices, you might have to have the loggers clear out a lot of the wood. You know, like if you need to buy a house somewhere, you got to send your kid to college, so you really need to be earning $100,000 a year for the next 10 years, and the price per acre for your land in terms of renting it out is so low that you really just need to rent it all out to make the $100,000 per year, you might tell the logger, yep, chop all the trees down. But if the price you can charge per acre is 10 times that, well, then now you know you're meeting all these other financial obligations you had, and you might not have the loggers come in. You might leave a lot of it undeveloped. And so if you look, and so in terms of the market and what's the quantity of acres that you are renting out to sharecroppers or to, you know, commercial real estate developers or whatever, you could, you know, if you plotted that, it would paradoxically show that as the price went up, the amount you were willing to supply, the quantity you were willing to supply, could eventually flip around and start going down. Okay, Rothbard talks about the psychic benefits of labor. And here the point is, I'm just making a silly example on saying, you know, imagine someone could be working in a factory producing cigarettes, or somebody could be working in the Mises Institute. So the Mises Institute has a few full-time staff, people that have to maintain the books in the library, people that have to be in charge of, like, taking book orders and packing them in boxes and shipping them out, or someone's got to be there to answer the phone, that kind of stuff. So the point is, you can imagine there'd be some people that wouldn't, they would be willing to work at the Mises Institute for a lower hourly wage than they would in the cigarette factory. And Rothbard's point is, as long as those types of preferences are prevalent enough, then that can have a noticeable impact on the equilibrium market wage rate. So it's not enough that just one or two people feel that way, because then they would just be the ones that would go to the respective place. And, you know, people who didn't care one way or the other would just go to wherever the highest wage was. But the idea is, it is possible, even the equilibrium, that working in a cigarette factory has a higher money wage rate than working at the Mises Institute, or working for a nonprofit in general, or working at the library, or, you know, however broad you want to make the classification, just because so many people would feel kind of funny working at a cigarette factory. So it's not that those issues of you know, squeamishness, or maybe, you know, some people are worried just about handling that much tobacco and everything. Maybe they're worried they're going to somehow have negative health effects from that. So the point is, you know, as economists, you think on the margin. It's not that because of those prevalent attitudes, cigarette factories would shut down. No, what happens is, in equilibrium, the money wage rate is higher for that, so, because it has to induce people to be willing to go there. So it is, when, you know, the price is right, people will go there and show up for work. It's just that they do need that compensating premium. Okay, there's some other issues that a lot of times come up when people are thinking about wage rates or salaries, and I just want to make sure you guys are handling it properly within a subjectivist framework in terms of looking at the incentives and understanding what employers do and what the workers do, and why it's the case that some of these outcomes happen. All right, so one major thing is, you know, Rothbard talks about these things, is that suppose there are certain occupations where, in order for you to get into that area, you have to undergo, sorry. Sorry, I'm just going to have to let that ring. I can't shut it off from here. So suppose that there are certain occupations where you have to go significant amounts of education or some other types of training in order to become eligible to be a practitioner in that field and then earn the wage rates or the salary that we're talking about with our, when we speak of statistics of these things. So obvious examples would be things like becoming a doctor. There, you know, you have to, not only do you have to spend a lot to go to medical school, but then there's a lot of time commitment involved. Or becoming a college professor, you know, it's not merely, you know, when as an economist, when you're looking at various attributes of different types of careers, if you were looking at being a college professor and say, well, that's pretty nice, you know, they get summers off, they get a lot of traveling that they can do, you know, their workload week to week, even when they're in session, isn't that bad, you know, they get a lot of people adoring them and thinking they're real smart and everything, and that's, you know, that's a pretty nice lifestyle, and their salary is pretty good, and they get health benefits compared to, you know, being a manager in a Fortune 500 company. You're weighing the pros and cons, and you're trying to figure out what people are attracted to. One of the things you would want to consider is to get tenure at a nice prestigious university. You almost certainly have to have a PhD in that field, and that is a pain. All right, it doesn't cost you money out of pocket, because typically someone's gonna pay for it. But the point is, you have to give up 5, 6, 7, 8 years of your life when somebody who goes into the business world is gonna be earning a higher salary during those years, whereas you're just gonna be hitting the books and basically eating ramen noodles while you're in grad school if you're going to become an academic. Okay, so that's, you need to take that into consideration. Okay, so, and the same, it's even more obvious with lawyers or doctors, where, you know, a lawyer could get out of law school and owe $200,000 in debt, but think, okay, I'm going to land a really good job, and then I'll have the income to pay down that debt. So the issue there is, there's a sense in which people loosely will say, oh yeah, well, you know, surgeons, brain surgeons, heart surgeons have to make $400,000 a year to pay for medical school. All right, that's the way they talk. So we'll come back to this in a second. And there's a similar thing going on with risk premia that, for example, here, you know, people who work on skyscrapers, like just even something silly like window washers who work on skyscrapers and are up there on the 60th floor, where if something goes wrong, they'll plummet to a certain depth, compared to guys who wash windows in more standard office buildings or for residential property, the people who are doing the riskier thing are going to make more, typically, as an hourly wage. Or coal miners, they're going to earn a higher wage than someone who does a job that's of comparable, requiring a comparable physical exertion, but there's not a chance of there being a cave-in. And you get buried alive. Okay, so how does that manifest itself? Is that, so let me just show, so I'm showing you now this slide C. I just want to make sure you guys are handling that the right way in our framework for how do you explain equilibrium wage rates. So again, let me just back up. It's certainly true that when people say, oh, it matters, if you have to endure years of medical school and then, you know, doing your residency and that kind of stuff, and so you're 10 years behind before you really start making the money as a doctor, and then you're going to have hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt from schooling, that is a definite consideration. And it is true that if that's what the case, in equilibrium, the salaries that doctors earn will be higher than they otherwise would have been. Or the same thing for lawyers and so forth. And it's also true that in occupations where there's more hazard involved, it has to be the case in equilibrium that the workers in those occupations earn a higher monetary wage compared to other occupations that requires similar skill set and so forth, and the only real difference is the danger that you could die or, you know, get hurt, whatever. So those things are all true, but a lot of times people, they don't, they think that those are exceptions, okay? So a lot of times, even the way it'll come across in a standard mainstream textbook is that first people will present the general theory and say, oh, wage rates are determined by marginal productivity. And then you get the sense that there's these other considerations that are put on top of that or that supplement that, so that you might think, well, yeah, normally the employer is going to, you know, the doctor will earn what his marginal product requires in equilibrium. Oh, but wait a minute, we got to think about the fact that he had to pay for medical school, so he's got to earn more. Okay, so I'm trying to tell you, no, don't think like that. That's wrong. The general principles we talked about before are still true. The employer, so it's not the case, and people talk about this sometimes too, they'll say, oh yeah, well, you know, like the guys who own the skyscrapers, they have to pay $50 an hour to get those guys to go up on the scaffolding and to wash the windows because it's so dangerous, you know, that, so that they have no choice but to pay that. And I'm trying to caution you against talking like that, that it makes it sound like they're not obeying the general principles that we've discussed for the generic labor market, and that's incorrect. All these cases are handled just fine by our standard principles. So what happens is you have this demand curve for labor, and that is based entirely on the employer's estimate of the discounted marginal value product. But the way those other considerations kick in is that the supply curve of labor for a particular occupation will go down as it becomes more expensive or more dangerous to get into that occupation. All right, so one way of seeing it is, suppose the government comes along and they pass a new requirement. Let me put it this way. Let's start from scratch. So suppose we've got this initial equilibrium. There's the demand curve by hospitals for heart surgeons, and here's the supply curve of heart surgeons. And you have this equilibrium wage rate or salary, and so surgeons are making $250,000 a year, and there's this quantity of people who have gone into that occupation and are surgeons. Now the government comes along and they pass some new things saying, oh, if you want to be a surgeon, we require that you spend one more year in residency. So because of that now, so now on the margin, it's less attractive to be a surgeon because now there's that extra hurdle before you can be, you know, earning that full salary. So that means fewer people are now going to choose to go into that. They're going to, on the margin, the people who are just willing to become surgeons, now because you have that extra hurdle, people who otherwise, you know, would have been the marginal ones flowing into that, now they're going to go do something else. Maybe they're going to be veterinarians or something, or maybe they're going to just be general practitioners or something, you know, depending on the regulation and what the specifics are. So the supply curve of those particular types of surgeons shifts to the left. And so now the new equilibrium, the price goes up. So now surgeons make, whatever, $275,000 a year. But there's fewer people who are now in that occupation. There are fewer surgeons. So from the hospital's point of view, because there are fewer surgeons, now that's why the marginal value, the discounted marginal value product is higher. Because now the surgeons are scarcer. So there's, you know, now the amount of surgery that can happen is lower now. And so on the margin, the value produced or the extra profitability of a particular surgeon is higher than otherwise would have been. Okay, so it's not that the hospital is running the numbers and saying, well, the productivity is still the same, but now we have to pay them more because of this regulation. That's not the way you handle it economically. It's that the supply of surgeons went down, and so in the new equilibrium, the quantity is higher, and so you moved along that original demand curve. And it's the same thing if you wanted to look at the owners of a skyscraper and them being willing to hire people to clean the windows. It's ultimately, if somebody's earning $50 an hour to clean the windows, it's because that's what his marginal product is. And the reason that's, even so normally, that would never be the case for people washing windows outside of your conventional house. You wouldn't have to pay $50 an hour for that, because if you were, tons of people would flow into that. People would say, holy cow, yeah, I'll start washing windows for $50 an hour. And so the supply, that's not the actual supply curve. The quantity supplied would go way up, and then more and more houses would be hiring them until you reach the point at which, on the margin, no one else wanted to hire someone to come wash their windows. All right. So it's always the case that in an unhampered market, at least, the employer is hiring based on considerations of discounted marginal value product. So when we talk about these other complications, we're just showing you in practice the types of things that can influence the worker's supply curve of labor. And that's the way it affects the equilibrium wage rate. Okay, Rothbard talks about capital accumulation and labor productivity. So here, this is a very quintessentially Austrian point. So let me just make sure you get this, that in the Austrian view, it's not that other schools of thought are unaware of this, but this is the kind of thing that the Austrians stress, because they're really big on capital. So I think a lot of people, when they think about, if you grab a person off the street and you said, hey, is our standard of living today higher than it was 200 years ago? The person is going to say, of course it is. We're much higher standard of living now. We're phenomenally wealthy now, have a much higher real wage rate, if the person knows the economics jargon, now than we did 200 years ago. But then if you say, okay, why is that the case? Why is it that your house basically looks like the Jetsons compared to even what a king could have enjoyed 200 years ago? Why is that? I think most people would say, oh, it's because of technology. They would think it's because our physicists and chemists and engineers have just stumbled upon new knowledge. And now we just have better recipes for turning inputs into outputs. And that's why they would say the productivity of labor is so much higher than it was 200 years ago. That's why a person just working 8 hours a day and 40 hours a week right now can produce a much higher amount of real output than somebody working 100 hours a week could have done 200 years ago. So in the Austrian view, that's not right. That yes, it is, of course, there's been technological progress. We know we have better ideas now about how to turn inputs into outputs, but a large part of what has happened, and to understand why are our workers so much more physically productive now, is that we have more capital goods. And so that's just against the Austrian point, stressing the importance of saving and investment, that's the way you grow richer as an economy. The Austrians also, I don't know if Rothbard gets into this in this part, but Mises certainly is big on saying, when we in the West pat ourselves on the back about being so much richer and having such a higher standard of living than the relatively backward countries in Africa or South America, whatever, it's not because the European or the American worker is that much more skilled. So there is that aspect to it, but it's also because the worker has much more equipment and tools at his disposal in these first world countries. Okay, and in fact, the United States, I know people that hire, like my uncle is a roofer, and he hires guys from Mexico, you know, that he just knows where to go for certain jobs and hires them, you know, probably illegal what he's doing. But part of why he does that, you know, and he has to, you know, it takes him a while to figure out who's a good worker or not, but he, you know, says that if you get the right guys, I mean, they are much harder workers than any American you're going to hire. And, you know, so when you say in general, you know, why is it that Americans tend to have a much higher wage rate than workers in Mexico, and why is it that typically it's Mexican workers who are trying to sneak over the border in the United States and not vice versa, and why is it that in Europe, you know, they have to have immigration controls to prevent people from trying to get into their country, you know, why aren't people leaving Germany and the United States to try to go find work in Africa? It's again, so it's not that, you know, it's not the American educational system is cranking out all of these amazingly skilled human beings, and that the African educational system is backward. That's not the main difference, or at least that's not the sole difference. One of the main differences in the Austrian emphasis is on the capital accumulation. And there also, if you push it back even further and say, okay, well, that's kind of weird, then why is it? So, well, let me just finish that point, and then I will explain why it's the case. So the average worker has more tools and equipment to work with. So just realize that, you know, you might have thought before that the distribution of output, if it's really the case that there's a worker in Africa who's working with very limited tools, and then there's a United States worker who has all these complex machines and powerful computers and stuff supplementing his labor, you might have thought before you studied economics that if the workers are interchangeable, they're still going to get the same really low wage rate, and that the owners of the capital goods are going to be the ones to reap the profits, or the income, I should say, from the contribution of the capital goods. But in general, no, that's not right. That for a given amount of capital goods, it's still the case now that having one additional hour of labor yield that much more product. You know, another hour of labor really is that much more productive if the labor is working in tandem with a bunch of capital goods. And so even though, so it's still the case that the hourly wage rate equilibrium is going to be higher when there's more capital. So maybe that's one way of looking at it, that as there's more savings and investment and the amount of capital goods increases, that tends to push up wage rates, even though you might initially have thought that those two shouldn't have anything to do with each other. And it, again, just, you know, you think through the logic of it, and, you know, Rothbard lays out why that's the case, just because we already pointed out the employee in equilibrium is going to get paid in accordance with how much more profit does the employer make because of the employee working that extra hour. And it's just the case that with extra capital good, that number's higher. Okay, so now, if you wonder, then you say, okay, but how, what happens with the capitalist, you know, the person who owns the capital goods, I should say? Well, it's also true that the capital goods earn their marginal productivity in terms of the rental rate or the discounted rents, in terms of the, you know, the asset price, if the capital good is being sold outright. So that's still true. So it's not that we're violating any marginal principles. I'm just pointing out those marginal principles lead to the result that workers get higher wages the more capital goods there are. So the one thing that is interesting, and this is, and what would happen in a completely unfettered world of unfettered free trade, and where there were strong private property rights all over the world, what would happen is that capital goods would go from the countries that are relatively rich to the relatively underdeveloped countries. So if we had a system of Rothbardian anarcho-capitalism across the whole globe, what you would see is yes, you would have workers would tend to be moving from, you know, like the African regions to Europe and the United States, but at the same time, you would have a huge movement of capital goods from Europe and the United States to Africa or to Mexico. And in particular, what you would see is financial capital would be flowing out so that the production of capital goods would now shift, right? Because it's, you know, it's expensive to physically transport factories from one country to the other, even though it does happen now. But the idea is really what would happen is instead of building the 1,000th factory in the United States, they would build the 5th factory in Zimbabwe, if you get what I'm saying. So the idea is new production of capital goods on the margin would tilt heavily towards those areas right now that are impoverished in terms of capital goods. And that's the way, and so that would make, you know, wage rates in those areas start shooting up at very high rates of growth. So that would start, you know, so labor would have less and less of an incentive to shift from those areas to the ones right now where wage rates tend to be higher. All right, so if you ask, okay, in the real world right now, then why isn't that happening? Well, it's because of lots of government intervention, and one of the main reasons is private property rights aren't very secure in those areas. And so in a capitalist right now who has $1 million to invest, it's true that the marginal product of a backhoe, you know, or a cement mixer, you know, so think of just the capital good. How much could the capitalist who owns those things, how much could he earn per hour renting them out? It's probably going to be the case that the hourly rate is much higher in Africa than in the United States, at least in, you know, at least in certain areas of Africa where, you know, there is development. And so if you say, well, gee, then why doesn't he just take his $1 million and buy a bunch of cement mixers and put them on a ship and shut them down there? You know, why doesn't he? Because there's a much greater chance that the Zimbabwean government is going to nationalize them, and then he's going to be out of investment. Whereas, as things progress, it wouldn't be surprising if the Obama administration nationalized them too. But you get the point. So that's partly what is happening there. So that's why Mises stresses this a lot in his work, that he's saying what these underdeveloped nations need is not foreign aid from other governments. What they need is an institution, you know, strong private property rights and a sound currency, and then investors will send capital there, meaning financial capital, and then that will allow the production of physical capital goods, which will raise the productivity of labor in those regions. And that's the way their standard of living is going to come up. So the issue is it's not because people say, oh, well, they need to get trained in Western universities and bring back our way. And Mises' point is they know that's not the issue. You know, it would only take a handful of scientists from the West to go to these areas and teach their plant managers the right way to do stuff. You know, it's not an issue of that they just don't know how to do it. The issue is they don't have the requisite capital investment. And that's why they're relatively poor. And so they need investment of actual capital goods or the production of capital goods. It's not that we have to have student exchange programs and stuff like that, and they just need to learn about our way of life, except if by that we mean they need to understand the Western approach to private property and just why, you know, the tradition of classical liberalism and also the tradition of sound money. Because that's the other thing. Even if the government doesn't literally expropriate you in terms of just seizing your property and saying it's not yours anymore, it's ours, but if they debase their currency and then institute capital controls and stuff like that so that technically you still own your factory, but you're not allowed to repatriate the profits, that they just sit over there building up in a bank account in that country and you're not allowed to exchange their currency for your own domestic currency at the market rate because they have a, you know, dictator in charge down there, well, then you've effectively been dispossessed. Okay, so that's what Mises' recommendations are for these impoverished African nations and things like that that have a, you know, tradition of colonialism. He's saying that that's not why they're poor. They're poor because they have socialist governments. Okay, hang on a second. Let me jump ahead here. I just got to remind myself of how much time I have here. Okay. So the so here, this is going to overlap. I know some of you have taken me for the Krugman and Keynes class, but the overlap's not perfect. So I'm going to apologize for some of you. This is going to be something you heard me talk about just a few weeks ago, but again, I can't assume everyone is overlapping here. So Rothbard spent some time talking about the Keynesian assumption of orthodox, sorry, John Maynard Keynes in the General Theory, so that was the classic work that came out in 1936 that established what we now know of as Keynesian economics. What Keynes does in that book is the reason he calls it the General Theory is he's trying to show that his system is more general in the same way that like Einstein's theory of relativity could handle more cases than Isaac Newton's. And so if you're familiar with physics, what actually happened is, and this is pretty elegant, it's kind of neat in terms of the history of thought and the natural sciences, Einstein's equations and Einstein's framework showing like the way clocks would measure time and the way distance would be measured and the way mass would be measured and so forth. He had these equations that were true for any velocity, anywhere from, you know, being at rest to the speed of light. And it wasn't the Newtonian system. But what was interesting is as long as the speeds or the velocities were low relative to the speed of light, then the Einstein, you know, framework reduced down to the classical mechanics of Isaac Newton. And so it was kind of neat to show it's not that Newton was just totally wrong, it's that he came up with a framework that was pretty good, that was almost right in describing the natural world as long as the particles you were looking at weren't moving very quickly relative to each other. But in general, Newton was wrong. Okay, so that's the idea. So Keynes was, I think, quite consciously trying to show economists that that's what he had done in economics. So he wasn't saying that the orthodox classical economists were just completely wrong. He was trying to show that, oh, no, all the things they're talking about, like Say's Law, and, you know, the sort of thing that Basquiat would talk about in the broken window story, those sorts of things. You see, those are all right, and yes, there are trade-offs, and it's true. If the government spends more money creating jobs over here in this sector, well, then that's going to siphon resources away from us somewhere or destroy jobs elsewhere. That reasoning is all correct if we were initially at full employment. And then Keynes is going to say, but once we relax that assumption and we look at the system and economies in general where we might not be at full employment, then those classical postulates break down or the classical wisdom and policy recommendations break down, leaving the door open for Keynesian intervention, like, you know, deficit spending or monetary intervention. Okay, so that's what Keynes was doing rhetorically. And so that's what Rothbard touches on here. Now let me give a little plug for those of you who have taken the, well, it doesn't matter if you took the first one or not, those of you taking the class right now, I'm excited to teach, and so I really strongly encourage you to sign up for the third part in this series where we cover the last third of Rothbard's book, because there is the best critique of Keynesianism that I've ever seen, or at least I should say, you know, word for word. It's the most succinct and crushing critique of Keynesianism. So here, Rothbard gives you just a little hint, but it's in subsequent chapters, which we're going to cover if you take, you know, this for the third part of the series, where he just goes through and just obliterates what we have all learned of as Keynesian economics. All right, so here, like I said, he just gives a little taste of it. All right, so Rothbard has a few things to say about this. So he says, first of all, it's not true that the orthodox economists, certainly not the ones in the Austrian tradition, assume full employment. And he says that notion is coming from Keynes's own approach to economics being based on physics. That, you know, in physics, you sort of, you know, you make assumptions about how the world works, and then you derive predictions from that, and then you can go conduct experiments and see if is that true. And Rothbard is saying that's not, certainly not the way Austrian economics works, that there's nowhere that we ever assume full employment. And he says, what we can say, though, is that on an unhampered market, there is no such thing as involuntary unemployment. That at any given time, anybody who wants to work at the going wage rate can get work. And he even pushes it, and he says there's really no such thing as an idle laborer, because even the limit, even if somebody's productivity were negative, he could pay the employer for a job. So Rothbard says, see, there's no limit on there being enough jobs. Okay, it's not like at any given time there's just a set number of jobs in the economy, and oh shoot, once those are filled, if we happen to have more job seekers, well, then they're out of luck, and they're going to be idle resources. Rothbard's point is that, no, as long as the wage rate is flexible, and the point, perhaps you didn't, Rothbard might seem very flippant right there, so let me just explain why he made that argument. Because obviously, if somebody's very concerned about high unemployment rates, like right now, you know, in the United States, it's officially above 9%. I know in some European countries, it's much higher. So somebody's concerned about the unemployed, and that is a very tragic issue. And so then if you read Rothbard, and he says, no, I mean, come on, there's no unemployment problem. If somebody, it's not, you know, there's no issue of creating jobs. I mean, the unemployed worker could just pay his boss to give him a job. So that it can sound like, oh my gosh, I can't believe these heartless free marketeers. The reason Rothbard is doing that is he's trying to isolate and be precise with the language. His point is, it's not the case that what the unemployed worker wants is just a job. Because he says, anybody can get a job, if he's willing to work for nothing. So I mean, to give you an example of this, I've been arguing with people on my blog about stuff, and the guy Carl Smith actually, in his blog, the guy I debated recently, they're coming around, you know, saying things like, the unemployment per se is a problem, and that's in Rothbard's book here too. That's partly where he got off on this tangent. Is he's tackling this notion that unemployment is a problem, because I was making the point that no, actually, by itself, in and of itself, labor is a bad thing. That other things equal, we want more leisure. It's a good thing if we can produce the same amount of goods and services with less labor expended. That's progress. And so a lot of people were giving me flack for that, saying, oh yeah, that's, you know, try telling that to somebody who's unemployed right now, that them having a job isn't a good thing. And so my response is, okay, you know, I'm not, I'll call your bluff. All those, you know, the 10 million people who are unemployed right now, I'll give them a job. They can come to my house and cut the grass, and I'll give them a dollar every time they do it. How's that? And I'll have them paint my house, and I'll give them a dollar. And I'll have them, you know, change the oil in my car, assuming that they can show me they know what they're doing. I'll give them a dollar. Okay, they can go through and sort the books in my office, and I'll give them a dollar. So you can see those people wouldn't take me up on that. So the point is, it's not really that they want a job. What they want is a job that pays a minimum salary or wage rate that they find acceptable. Okay, so that's what Rothbard's doing here. He's not just being a jerk and saying, oh, I don't care about unemployed people. He's trying to be clear that it's not that people want a job. They want a job that pays a certain amount. And it's sloppy language when we just talk the other way. And in fact, it's not just that it's careless, it's that you're missing what the real issue is here. So the real issue is, wait a minute, what's going on? How come it's the case? How can there be these millions of people who are skilled enough to work at these particular jobs? They want to work for those wage rates that other people are getting, and yet they can't get employers to offer them more. And Rothbard says, well, it's because something is stopping the wage rate from falling, and that's the cause of institutional, or what we might call involuntary unemployment. And in the next part of the book, Rothbard will much more systematically go over the various government and union interventions into the free market that cause that. Incidentally, let me just clarify, there's nothing wrong with unions per se. So Rothbard is not anti-union, so long as they're not violating property rights. The problem is what ends up happening in practice is governments use their police power to basically stop employers from using violence against unions, but they let unions use violence against the employers, or at least that's what has happened more recently. People who are pro-union would say that things were much different 200 years ago or 100 years ago. So when I say that unions prop up wage rates, I don't mean a voluntary thing where people just, workers form an association and decide collectively, hey, do we want to work at this factory or do we want to not work there? That's totally fine in Rothbard's view. What's not fine is if the workers say, we don't want to work unless we get a pay hike, and if we catch somebody else who's not in our union trying to go and work for that employer, we're going to beat them up. And that's the way we're going to put pressure on the employer to give us a raise. That, of course, is a violation of the property rights. That's not the free market. And as I've argued elsewhere, it's not even that, oh, we need the government to use the police to crack down on the union and to punish them for beating up SCAB. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that government just needs to be neutral. That if the unions want to have their thugs go up and beat people up in a free market, the employers would have no problem with that. They would just go hire some private security force that would come in, you know, with tear gas canisters and, you know, riot gear and stuff like that, rubber bullets, and they would take care of the union marchers really quickly. You know, the protesters who were standing outside on private property, they dispersed that crowd pretty quickly. Or they would, you know, bring in so-called SCAB, replacement workers, in armored personnel carriers, or they'd go through helicopters or whatever. It wouldn't be an issue. The employer would not have to just cave into union demands so long as the government stayed out of it. But what happens is the government will come in and protect the union. So if the employer tried to hire armored personnel carriers and guys coming in with, you know, body armor and tear gas canisters to get rid of the union protesters, the police would come and arrest those guys. And so you can't do that. What are you talking about? You know what I mean? So that's what I'm getting at here, that it's not because a lot of times free market people, when they're complaining about unions, actually end up saying, we want the government to punish the unions for beating people up. And I just realized within the last year or two that that's kind of odd for a Rothbardian to talk like that. But it makes it sound like you're saying, if only we had more government intervention, the market would work better. And so I realized that, no, that's not actually what's going on. It's that there's too much government intervention. The government is using its police power too much, namely by preventing employers from coming up with private solutions to unions who are violently protesting. Okay, we've got about, 15 minutes left for the main lecture, then I'll turn over to your questions. Rothbard talks about the typical mainstream textbooks focus on cost curves. So, he proudly says that you'll notice in this book, I don't have any of that stuff. So here I just reproduced something so you know what he's talking about. Here this MC is the marginal cost curve, and then this ABC is the average variable cost, and then you have the ATC, which is the average total cost, and the marginal cost curve cuts these things at their lowest points. So anyway, if you're going to take a standard microeconomics course, even at a free market school, like I taught this stuff when I taught at Hillsdale College, I actually got into this stuff that I would bring my colored chalk to class, and I would draw the different curves and everything, and I would show different types of equilibrium based on the industry. And I mean, so it was fun because just for geometrical reasons, but it actually didn't do that much in terms of the economics. I mean, there was some of the economics involved, but it was more like you had to be a good economist first, and then you could draw the curves and maybe illustrate a few points with curves. But if you didn't already know sound economic theory, the curves would just screw you up. And that's actually what I noticed happening is that with some students, we would go halfway through the semester and I would ask some really basic questions, something that literally anybody with common sense would have gotten right on the first day of class. And yet, a bunch of the class got it wrong because they were trying to use the economic tools that we had been teaching them. And so that really disillusioned me when I realized, oh my gosh, the standard textbook stuff that I feel I have to teach them is actually making people worse economists. That I'm, that just naturally they knew the way the business world would work when they first came to me, and then I knocked that out of their head. I beat it out of them and gave them all these dumb cost curves that made them think the wrong way. Okay, so again, let me just be clear. Handled properly, you can illustrate certain points very easily using these graphical approaches. And I think that's part of the reason that real sharp mainstream economists like doing this stuff is because it can be very precise. And if you're good at math, it can be elegant. And, like I say, it's kind of fun. I like going to class on these days and I get to draw all the stuff and do the deadweight loss and shade it in using the orange chalk, and then I would do something else with the red chalk. It was kind of fun. But by the time the class was over, the board looked really cool, and I didn't even want to erase it. I just left it up there for the next, for the history professor that was going to walk in just to see the pretty diagram I drew. But in terms of conveying economic knowledge to the students, it was largely a waste of time. And in fact, like I said, in some cases, it was actually counterproductive that the students knew less about the economy after having listened to me go through this stuff for a few weeks. So one of the things Rothbard points out is that one of the major problems with this stuff is that they all assume prices, fixed prices. That when you draw all these curves, this is from the perspective of an individual firm, and it's just showing things like, oh, okay, so as my quantity goes up, this is the marginal cost at first is diminishing, and then it bottoms out, and then it starts rising. And then you can see the same thing with all the other cost curves. But what that's showing is this information is based on particular unit prices for the various inputs, what's the wage rate for the type of laborers I need for this product, or how much does the electricity cost per kilowatt hour, that kind of stuff. And so that's where these things are coming from. So the whole point of all this is just you're going to use this information to then derive the supply curve for the individual firm. And then once you have that, you can aggregate it and then come up with the supply curve for the industry or for the market. And so Rothbard's point is it's a little bit weird that what we're doing, how can I put it? So what they're doing here is they're trying to come up with the derivation of the supply curve, and then they're going to have that intersect the demand curve to come up with the price. And so, and they would explain that for every, so you say, okay, but what about the laborers who are in this market? So the wage rate that's in equilibrium that this particular firm is taking as a given, well, how is that wage rate determined? You say, oh, well, that's because of the supply and demand for labor in the labor market. And then you say, okay, but what about, you know, the electricity that we were talking about? Well, how's that term? The company that produces the electricity, they have their marginal cost curves and da-da-da-da. So Rothbard's point is you're largely arguing in a circle when all is said and done, that you're using these marginal cost curves and so forth to explain market prices, but you can't even draw these curves unless you first had market prices. Okay, this is, hang on, let me just check and see. Okay, just to paste myself. I figured, you know, since this is the final lecture, I just wanted to make sure you guys didn't get out of this course without hearing some of these points. So this is not necessarily following step by step what Rothbard's doing here in the end of chapter 9, but like I say, I just realized, you know, this is the last 10 minutes you're going to have for me in this class, and you should know this stuff. So this is all consistent with Austrian economics, and it's scattered throughout Man, Economy, and State, all these points, but I just want to summarize it all since Rothbard here is talking about cost. So in the subjectivist framework, cost is ultimately what we call opportunity cost. So it's the subjective value placed on the next best alternative. So cost is not really monetary expenditures. And that's part of the problem with these kind of diagrams is that, you know, when you're trying to figure out how many units of something will a firm produce and that sort of thing, I mean, strictly speaking, cost is subjective. And I remember in my courses with the students, I would, in the beginning, we would go over real Austrian-friendly stuff, just general principles of economics, like there are always trade-offs and there's always scarcity and people make decisions on the margin and value is subjective. And when an exchange occurs, as long as it's voluntary, both parties expect to benefit. And so I would go over these general principles that Murray Rothbard would have no problem with. But then once we got to the material where I had to teach this stuff with the cost curves, I would tell the students, I said, look, you know how I told you in the first week of class that cost is subjective and that cost isn't the amount of money you spend on something? And they were saying, yeah. I said, well, forget all that. When you're drawing these curves and you're thinking about this stuff, you're going to get all screwed up. Just, you know, think about cost as being how many dollar bills the owner of the firm has to pay for things, because that'll make sense. So that's part of the problem with this whole framework here, is that to do it right and to, you know, draw the curves correctly and to apply it to real-world numerical examples, you know, it's easy as just to think about cost the way the layperson thinks about it. But the point is here, actually, in terms of economic theory, no, cost is not. When you say what's the cost of a decision, you don't mean you don't mean how much money did you spend, right? Strictly speaking, the cost is the subjective value placed on the next best alternative. So, for example, let's say there's a girl, a young woman, who is being courted by several different suitors. Like there's three different guys that want to marry her. And so the one guy proposes to her and she says yes. Now you say, okay, what's the cost of her decision to marry that guy, to marry bachelor number one? It's not, the way you figure that out is you don't say, oh, okay, well, they spent $10,000 on the reception. They went on a honeymoon that cost $3,000, so that's $13,000. That's not right. What you're doing there is you're measuring the monetary expenditures, perhaps that the, not even by the woman, right? If her dad paid for that stuff, then that's not a cost to her of the decision, unless she would have gotten a higher inheritance if she had stayed unmarried, and then her dad died with a bigger estate because he didn't have to pay for his daughter's wedding. Okay? I mean that's the way you'd have to handle it. The correct way to think about it, when you say what is the cost of her decision to marry bachelor number one, you have to say, strictly speaking, okay, you look at what is her utility or happiness or subjective, whatever, psychic experience, benefits from her life now that she's made the decision to marry bachelor number one, and contrast that with what would be her subjective level of well-being if she hadn't married him and she had done her next best alternative. So maybe that means marrying bachelor number two, or maybe that means not getting married at all and she devotes her life to her work and doesn't have a family. Maybe that's, if she couldn't marry bachelor number one, maybe that's what she would do with her life. So that's the true cost. The cost is the value she would have placed on the decision now, the option now that she can't have because she made the decision to marry bachelor number one. So another interesting thing here is that costs are always anticipated. They're never actually realized. Because if you just think through what I said there, the cost of her marrying bachelor number one is not how many dollars did you spend on the wedding cake and how many dollars did you spend buying the dress. The cost is the subjective value she would have placed on her, existence or life, whatever, had she not married that guy, and she'll never know. She doesn't know what that is. So that was always just an anticipation. Now, what's true is, she could have an idea. So if she marries bachelor number one and then 2 years later it turns out that he's an alcoholic or something and cheating on her, she might regret her decision. And so she could very plausibly say, I made a mistake and I would have been happier had I not married this guy. But strictly speaking, she doesn't know that. I'm making a contrived example here, but maybe she thinks, oh, I should have married bachelor number two. Well, maybe bachelor number two would have been even worse, because she doesn't know for sure. She's just estimating that. The point is, by its very nature, cost is always in anticipation. It's never actually realized. Another thing is that sunk costs are sunk. And here, what I just mean that a lot of times when people are dealing with cost, they make mistakes in this way. So a sunk cost means, in the conventional terminology, you've already made a decision, and you typically we're talking about paying money in this context, and that's already gone. And yet you're letting that influence your current behavior, even though in most, in a lot of cases, that sort of doesn't make sense. So let me just give you an example. Maybe you go to a fancy restaurant and, you're ordering off the menu and you don't, the stuff written in French and you don't speak French. So you order something that costs $100 or that has a price of $100. And they come and give it to you and you take one taste of it, it's like soup or something, and you take one, and it's just absolutely disgusting. That if you were in a deli somewhere and that thing had a price of $5 and the person put it in front of you and you tasted it, you wouldn't eat it. You wouldn't even consider eating it. But yet now that you're in the fancy restaurant, a lot of people will think, well, I paid $100 for this, I'm going to make myself eat it. So most economists there are going to say, no, that $100 is a sunk cost. It's gone. And like, strictly speaking, I'm violating my own rule here about costs aren't monetary expenditures. Strictly speaking, it's, you know, the value of what else, the subjective value you place on the next best thing you could have bought with $100. Okay, but you know, trying to handle two things at once here. So here the issue is that $100 is gone. If you, whether you eat that soup or not, you still have to pay for it. Okay, just make that assumption. You know, you can't send it back and say, you know, it's not that there's something wrong with it, it's just you don't like it. Okay. So if that's the assumption we're making, then the point is, if you wouldn't force yourself to eat it if it had only been $5, why are you forcing yourself to eat it when it's $100? That on the margin, now what's your decision? The $100 is gone either way. The question is just, do you want to eat that soup or do you not want to eat it? And if you think it tastes disgusting, then why are you eating it? Okay, so that's the standard way economists typically deal with those sorts of things. Now, I should say, and David Gordon brings this point up, and I think maybe Roderick Long, there's nothing, from an Austrian point of view, there's nothing irrational about behaving that way or acting that way. If I say to you, no, I paid $100 for this soup and I'm going to eat it, gosh darn it, I haven't done anything wrong or irrational. Okay, those could just be my subjective preferences and I'm doing it. You know what I'm saying? It's not like I contradicted myself or I did anything. I could have a PhD in economics and say that, and it's strictly speaking, that's okay. It's just, in a more loose sense, it does seem a little bit weird. It seems like a poor justification for what I'm doing. But my point is, that's still rational action in the Misesian sense. That it gives me more utility to not waste food that I spend a lot of money on. That could just be my preference. Okay, but I think you guys probably get the bigger picture that by talking through these things, sometimes economists think that we're helping clarify people's thoughts and maybe their preferences change. That maybe part of their preference is based on a faulty way of analyzing something. And once they realize that, oh yeah, I already did pay the $100 either way, and now the question is just, do I want to eat something that tastes disgusting? You know, once I clarify my thinking, oh, why would I want to eat something that tastes disgusting? So you see the point that's the role of the economist might play in that setting. Okay, and then I just thought I should end with a few points about the problems of the cost theory of value. And again, this is part of the problem with this type of framework. So don't misunderstand me. Modern mainstream economics is not espousing a cost theory of value. When you're drawing these cost curves, that's not what Adam Smith and David Ricardo were doing when they literally had cost theory or labor theories of value. That's not what's going on. So it's, you can draw these things and still be a believer in modern subjectivist value theory. The point is just, it's very misleading and it's easy to fall into mistaken ways of thinking when you're drawing all those cost curves all day. So anyway, let me just give you some problems with the actual cost theory of value, which tries to explain market prices based on costs of production. So a standard thing might be to say, your friends are going out, you know, you're with your, and you go to a Broadway show, okay, in Manhattan, Broadway, where they have, nice musicals and things like that. And you come out, and then you go to a restaurant that's down the street, and you just order a cup of soup, and you can't believe it costs $10 just for a little cup of soup. You can't believe it. Or you go to the convenience store just to get a can of soda, and it costs $3, and you can't believe it. And so what will happen is people might complain about that, but then somebody might say, oh, no, they have to charge that because the rent is so high in this area. You know, this real estate is very expensive, And so the people who own this store, they have to charge you $10 for a cup of soup, or they have to charge you $3 for a can of soda because their rental payment every month is so high. If they didn't charge you that, they'd be out of business, so that's why they have to. So that's a typical way of looking at something using a cost theory of value. And I mean that's correct as far as it goes, and I would much rather somebody say that than somebody saying, yeah, that's not fair. The government should pass a law saying that you're not allowed to charge more than a dollar for a can of soda. I mean, so somebody who realizes that there are incentives and that the business owners face constraints and that rent is high in Manhattan compared to real estate rental prices in Iowa, I mean, that person is a much better economist than somebody who's just completely naive. But my point is, now that you guys know Austrian price theory, you should be able to see that actually that's not really the full explanation. Really, you know, from an Austrian point of view, the reason that soda has a price of $3 is that people are willing to pay that. The subjective benefits on the margin are at least $3, or you know, the person gets more utility from that soda than from what they could have bought for the $3, so they make that exchange. And so that's an intersection of supply and demand curve. And the reason the supply of sodas is so restricted, the reason more people don't come in and offer soda to push down the price, since you know soda might sell for a dollar a few miles away, so why is it selling for $3 here? There's not an arbitrage precisely for that reason. That in order to set up that shop and to be able to sell the soda, you have to pay things, and so that's what keeps the supply curve of the soda constrained. But still, ultimately, the demand, you know, there has to be that demand aspect there, and people are willing to pay a lot because they get this, you know, they get happiness or subjective benefits just from being in Manhattan and going and seeing a Broadway show, and then when they come out, for the convenience factor, they're willing to pay $3 for soda rather than walking 20 blocks and getting it for a little bit cheaper in some, you know, some area that's not as desirable. Okay, so it's kind of like the same thing I was talking about before with the surgeons getting a higher wage rate because of medical school and that sort of thing. It's a similar thing in general that, yeah, the cost of production for any individual firm, you know, can help explain something, but in general, that no, I mean, remember, costs are simply prices themselves, and so you don't want to have a theory that explains prices by reference to costs because you're just moving in a circle. You don't want to say, oh, the reason soda has a price of $3 is that the cost of producing it here is, you know, $2.75, and so if the guy wants to make a little bit of a profit, he's got to charge $3. That's not a good explanation in general, because then you can say, well, then why does it to say it costs him $2.75, what you mean is that the prices of other things are certain numbers, and so then you're just, you know, at best you're just moving it back one. So you want to, as an economic theorist, you want to have a theory that starts from more fundamental principles and then builds up equilibrium prices for there. And so that's what Rothbard's given you. If you've taken the first and now the second sections here, you know how to go from more fundamental building blocks. You go from consumers' subjective preferences, and that's all you need to build up conventional supply and demand curves and then to figure out what the equilibrium price is. You don't need to refer to, oh, gee, what's the cost of production? The other thing, and I'll stop here, is at best, cost theories can explain the long-run equilibrium prices for reproducible goods. So if you want to, like, so there with this can of soda, loosely speaking, you know, it's not wrong per se to say that, okay, the reason that that thing has a price of $3 is if the store owner charged less than that, he would be losing money, and so he would stop doing it. And so it's got to be the case, if we see that can of soda there, that they're charging at least $3. But on the other hand, it's not $4, because since the cost of production is $2.75, if somebody were charging $4 for it, then more people, you know, would stock more soda, and they would sell more, and that would push down the price. Right? So at best there, you're explaining the price of soda in the long run, because if there's a storm coming in, and people are worried about running out of liquids and things, they might rush down to the stores and buy up everything off the shelves, you know, if there's a hurricane coming or if there's a snowstorm coming. And so assuming that there's no price controls by the government, you might see that the price of that same can of soda jumps up to $5 because the store owner realizes there's a mob of people coming to just clear out my shelves. And so right now, for the next 2 hours, I can charge $5 and still sell out. So there, if you ask, gee, how come the can of soda has a price of $5? It's not because of the cost of production. It's clearly because of scarcity and relative supply and demand. And then more generally, if you're looking at something like a Babe Ruth rookie card or a Mickey Mantle rookie card, and those are professional baseball players for the foreign viewers that were famous in the United States. So they the card of their first year in the professional sports has a high market price. But they're not making any more of those things. Or the price of a Van Gogh painting. There's not more of those being made now if it's an original. And yet those things have a market price, and that's clearly determined by subjective valuations. You wouldn't be able to explain the fluctuating market price of a Van Gogh painting original by reference to the cost of producing it. Okay, well, I'll stop there. Let me check to see if you guys have any questions. So I will get all caught up. I know some of you still have pending questions from previous weeks, so I will certainly get all caught up on that before the class officially ends. Remember, if you're taking, I'm logged in here. Remember, if you're taking the course for credit, you're going to have just a standard multiple choice that's going to open this Friday, you know, for all of next week, just on this week 8 material. And then after that, you're going to have the final exam. So as always, if you've taken courses from me, you know, I'll send out emails letting you know what's going on. But just keep that in mind if you're taking the course for credit. Okay, so this is production of the market process. Incidentally, while this is loading, let me just ask you guys, if you have any thoughts one way or the other, if you liked or didn't like having the guest lecture from Peter Klein, let me know that, please. And I don't mean, you know, I'm not asking you to say, oh, I like you better than Klein, or what I wouldn't want to hear is, oh, Klein's a much better teacher than you are. That's not so much what I'm asking. I mean, in general, does that work if there's a particular topic that I think another professor actually has more expertise? Does it work for me to bring that person in, or is it kind of like, well, no, you know, if I'm taking a Murphy class, I want all the lectures to be the kind of same, and if I want to know what Klein thinks, you know, he's teaching classes, I'll take his. That's the kind of feedback I'm looking for, if you want to see more of that type of thing, or if you think it makes more sense to keep things distinct. So like I said, you should send me an email. Don't just, like, fire off thoughts in the chat box there, because maybe some of it's delicate and you want to tell me something private. Okay, Jacob Champness said, on page 622, Rothbard says, the mill price of cement at a shorter distance from the consumer will equal the mill price of cement at the longer distance plus the freight differential. So now Jacob goes on to say, I just wanted to point out that this implies either different mill prices for cement from the same mill bound for different destinations, or it must only be true for the case in which all cement is bound for consumers in the same place. That is, if we alter Rockford's Detroit, Rochester, and New York City scenario such that the consumer population is split between New York City and Chicago, then the freight differentials between mills in Detroit and Rochester for cement bound for the two locations would most probably be different for each location and reversed in terms of the relative magnitudes. So that if there could only be one mill price at each mill, the statement that the mill prices differ by any one freight differential would be meaningless. I understand what you're saying, Jacob, but let me just think about this for 10 seconds here. Because I may have to go read. So, I'm agreeing with you conditionally that you're right, in case people want to know what I'm saying. So Jacob's concern is that when Rothbard is dealing with one issue, right, Rothbard's trying to show that when something's produced, you know, at the manufacturing site and then it has to be shipped to the ultimate customer, that shipping charges come into play. And so he's saying, so it sounds like we're doing a cost of production theory, but we're not really. We're just talking about what the equilibrium prices are going to be. So it's still always the case that in equilibrium, the price is, you know, the intersection of supply and demand, and that the consumer's marginal benefits is consistent with, you know, the good that he or she is buying. So, for example, instead of talking about mill prices, maybe think about oranges. Florida oranges are going to be, other things equal, are going to be more expensive in New York City than they will be in Florida, because you have to ship them from Florida to New York City. And so in equilibrium, it's got to be the case that the price of a Florida orange in New York City is high enough to both, you know, pay the thing to the grower and then also for the shipper to make something. But the point is, it's not that the people in New York are thinking, oh, this orange tastes pretty good, so I'd be willing to pay such and such for it. Oh, but then I have to pay more because of the shipping. No, the consumer doesn't care how it got there. All the consumer cares about is, do I like the taste of this thing, or, you know, worried about their health, saying, oh, I know oranges are good for me, so I want to eat them for that reason. And then what's the price tag? The consumer doesn't care whether they come from Florida or Martians bring them or they're, you know, grown down the street. But what happens is the supply in New York of Florida-grown oranges is lower because of that shipping cost. And so in equilibrium, the price is going to be higher, meaning that consumers are getting fewer Florida oranges, and that's why the marginal benefit is higher. So what Jacob is saying is he's making the argument that Rothbard is just assuming that the mill price of cement, or what's the same thing, like the amount, the wholesale price of oranges to the Florida grower is the same whether the grower is selling them to somebody who's shipping them to New York or selling them to somebody who's shipping them to, you know, just down the street. So I'll maybe think about this more, Jacob, so for sure, yeah, you're right, Rothbard is assuming that, but then I want to follow up and say, I think he's right to assume that. That, you know, if you just think about it, if one shipping company is paying $1 a pound for bulk oranges, and they're going to take them to New York City, and another shipping company is paying $1.10 per pound, and they're just going to take them down the street. Well, then why is the wholesaler selling them to the New York City shipper? Why doesn't he just sell all of it to the guy paying $1.10? Okay, so I think what Rothbard's getting at there is the law of one price. Okay, so I mean, you could come up with certain scenarios where, for some reason, this particular shipping company has to pay more for oranges than this one over here. But I think in general, you know, absent you making very particular assumptions, they would be paying the same amount, just like you wouldn't assume that a doctor in New York City has to pay more for oranges than a lawyer or than a guy who works at Taco Bell. That you just say, no, what's the price of oranges in New York City? By the same token, what's the wholesale price of oranges from Florida growers? But again, if you're saying something more complex than that, and I'm missing something, feel free to come back. All right, let me just answer one more live, and then I'll let you guys go, because I know it's late, especially for certain time zones. Okay. Jacob really has it out for Rothbard, and I'm, of course, kidding. I mean, this is good, Jacob, that you're really trying to make sure he's being consistent. Okay, so Jacob says, and this will be the last question, and then we'll wrap it up. On page 618, Rothbard says, since it is psychic and not money wage rates that are being equalized, money wage rates will be equalized throughout the world, plus or minus negative or positive psychic attachment components, end quote. And then Jacob says, doesn't it fly in the face of the notion of subjective value to speak of comparing psychic values or of adding or subtracting them? And isn't Rothbard ignoring his own strictures from earlier in the book against explaining human actions on the basis of indifference? Well, okay, for sure, I understand what you're saying. I don't have the book in front of me. I would need to go look up to see. Yeah, without doing further investigation, I'd have to agree with you for sure on the indifference part. So let me just make sure everyone gets what Rothbard's, the point he's trying to make here, and then what Jacob's critique is. So what Rothbard is clearly getting at here is he's trying to say there's no reason to expect in the unhampered market, even in the evenly rotating economy, there's no reason to suppose that money wage rates are going to be the same across all occupations, even if we're talking about occupations that require the same type of skills. So clearly, a starting guard for the LA Lakers is going to make more, is going to earn a higher salary than someone stocking the shelves at a grocery store. But you wouldn't say, well, gee, how come the people stocking shelves at the grocery store don't start working for the LA Lakers as starting guard? It's because they don't have the same skills. All right, so we're not even talking about that. We're saying even if we're talking about workers who are interchangeable from the employer's point of view, even so, there's no reason to suspect that with perfect certainty and everything, that all occupations will have the same money wage rate. And he's saying that's because there are other things that are important to workers besides just the wage. So the example I use was people might prefer to work at the Mises Institute rather than selling cigarettes to people or making cigarettes. And so in equilibrium, it would have to be the case that the hourly money wage rate in the cigarette factory is higher than what the Mises Institute has to pay to attract workers. So there's nothing, so in what for what I just said there, that's totally fine. So that's correct, and I don't think it's a violation of any Austrian principles. But then Jacob's point is, yeah, but the way Rothbard says it, he's saying that psychic wage rates will be equalized. So it's so Rothbard went beyond just saying money wage rates won't be equalized, and then he tried to give a replacement and say what will be equalized, and he came up with this concept of psychic wage rates. And so, yeah, I think you're right, Jacob, that because notice, money wage rates are objective. You could speak of the objective fact of are money wage rates equal or not across different occupations. That's a verifiable, measurable fact of the world. You could just go look. And run, and, you know, and so by the same token, you can claim there's no tendency for those numbers to be equalized. Fair enough. But the problem then is when you come in and say, oh, what is being equalized or what there is a tendency to be equalized is not the money wage rate, but the psychic wage rates. And as Jacob points out, what the heck does that mean? That at the very least, you're clearly doing interpersonal comparisons of utility. And then the other thing that's a problem, even beyond that, as Jacob is saying, is that it's not that they would be equalized so that people would be indifferent between going from one to the other. Really, wouldn't it be more consistent with Rothbard's approach to say the differences between them would get small enough such that nobody would gain by deviating? Just like Rothbard says that in equilibrium, it's not the case that the marginal unit of land earns zero rent. It still earns a positive rent. It's just a small one, because he's saying if it actually earns zero, then why is the owner of that selling it? You know, because it assumes infinitesimal units. So I think it's the same. Well, actually, that issue, Jacob, might not be true here, now that I'm thinking about it, because you could still say if there were a slight, you know, so two jobs that were otherwise equal, if one's paying one penny more, the worker would switch over, and that would keep happening, and you know, so I'm not as sure of it there. Like, for example, the law of one price. I don't think the law of one price violates Rothbard's strictures against the basis of indifference. And I think that's kind of what he's saying here. All right, so I definitely agree with you on the psychic thing, but the indifference, now that I'm thinking about it, I'm not so sure. Okay, well, we're way over time here, and thanks, everybody, for participating. And like I said, we'll send out an email. There'll be a Mises.org article at some point talking about version 3 of this. It won't be for a few weeks, though. Actually, I can tell you right now, we picked the date of when it's going to start, because we have the deal in Vienna, the Supporters Summit. So it's going to be starting on Wednesday, October 5th, is going to be the first lecture for part 3 of this. And we realized that we did this one too late, for at least in the United States. For people on the East Coast, this is too late. So that one is going to start at 6 p.m. Eastern time. So hopefully that'll be more convenient, at least for a lot of you. Okay, well, thanks, everybody, for tuning in, and I might see some of you in the next class.